Oh, that was awesome. So we basically, for the last year or so, we've been sort of exploring this topic of entanglement in gapless systems through the lens, I guess, of mostly quantum Monte Carlo or exact-ish numerics, if you want to call them that. I just want to highlight some of the papers and especially the work done by the students and postdocs, so a couple of whom are here, and Stephen's around somewhere. Hedgen Ju, Katie Hyatt at Santa Barbara, and Jean-Marie Stéphane is a postdoc who works with Paul Fenley. So a lot of this work is done in collaboration with Paul Fenley. Okay, so what are we talking about? All right, so for the uninitiated, most of this talk will be details about the so-called entanglement area law. And if you don't know what that is, maybe you're in trouble, because it only gets worse from here. But the area law is basically an area rule of thumb, which applies to the entanglement scaling, specifically the entanglement entropy. So this is the Rényi entropies, which sort of, you know, quantify the entanglement, the quantum entanglement of a subsystem embedded in a larger system. So I've called that subsystem A. And what the area law is the idea that the entanglement entropy between A and B, between these two bipartitions, scales as the boundary. So it's like the boundary rule of thumb. And it's a rule of thumb because it applies in many cases, sort of heuristically, when you have a finite length scale in your system, for example. A gap system would have an area law. But there's also violations. So if you have, you know, Fermi surface is a famous one. And you can also construct sort of artificial quantum information type systems that would clearly violate the area law. So this really is taking us to sort of a condensed matter perspective when we're talking about the area law. And there's been much work on the area law, particularly in gap topological states. Okay, and that's where this famous topological entanglement entropy comes out as a subleading scaling term. Okay, so here's a Rényi entropy, entanglement entropy, and here's the area law. So the A is just a non-universal coefficient in front of this boundary length. And the subleading term, which I'm going to call gamma in this talk, is a constant in the case where you have like a spin liquid, a gapped spin liquid. And the famous case when you have the simplest Z2 spin liquid, this is just minus log 2. So it's something to do with the quantum dimension there. So the motivation for this talk, in some sense, is whether or not we can extend the success of how we use entanglement to sort of classify these exotic gap systems to the world of gapless systems, and particularly stuff like maybe gapless spin liquids or quantum critical points. And when you start talking about gapless systems, things get much more complicated. Okay, essentially, instead of just having a subleading constant that's somehow universal that tells you some structure of your wave function, you get all sorts of shape-dependent functions. Okay, and that can be relatively complicated. It can depend on the corners in your subregion A, between your subregion A and B, or whether or not you have smooth boundaries or disks of certain radii, or whether you have topologically non-trivial structures. So all these things have to be taken into account for.
Are you working in real space the whole time?
I'll be saying D plus 1. So I'm going to be mostly working in real space dimensions of 2, okay, but quantum systems. But where there's some, when I'm talking about 1 plus 1 and stuff, I'll mention it, okay?
Right, when you say the shape dependence.
These are real space shapes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I've drawn everything like I'm talking about a real space 2 dimensions, and I'll mostly talk about that. So the shape dependence has the potential to be something very powerful that can identify, for example, the universality class or some other universal features of the wave function. And there's actually firm predictions out there. So Senthil and Brian Swingle have this one that kind of interests me in particular, where the subleading scaling term, when you're at a deconfined critical point, is somehow different in a controlled way from the subleading scaling term of a conventional quantum critical point. So I won't get into the details of that. But potentially, we have this tool that we can use for this sort of contentious field of deconfined quantum criticality, which might give us something new. In addition, there's sort of these more speculative, I guess, from our perspective, motivations where in higher dimensions, these subleading scaling terms could give us access to quantities that behave in some regular way or scale in some regular way under renormalization group flows. And I guess one hope is that we can, you know, mimic the success of things like the C theorem in 1 or 1 plus 1 dimensions, where the central charge of the conformal field theory, you know, can constrain the RG flows in a very non-trivial way. In some sense, giving constraints on your condensed matter phase diagrams in a non-trivial way. We'd like to maybe extend that to higher dimensional systems. And Tarun Grover has a really nice paper on this recently, and he's been giving a series of talks that I encourage you guys to look up if you're interested in this topic. So really what I'm going to do is just examine the shape dependence of this subleading scaling term at some very simple interacting quantum fixed points, okay? And the eventual goal is to make connection between, you know, some of these field theory ideas and concrete lattice calculations, or as concrete as I can make them. Okay, that was just some sort of pre-introduction. So the outline of my talk, I just want to review a little bit of what we know in one dimension, or what people know that applies to sort of the numerical tools that I'm going to talk about. And then I'm going to look at a couple two-dimensional, so spatially two-dimensional systems, where we have sort of non-trivial geometries that can give us subleading, universal subleading terms to the area law. And so the first thing about one dimension that I should point out is this idea of an area law is modified in a non-trivial way. So even this boundary rule of thumb that I was saying is actually modified in one dimension, and it's modified in a very important way. So in order to see this in a heuristic manner, there's a very simple sort of scaling argument that I can give you. And some people hate this, but I'm just going to do it anyway. So imagine I have a one-dimensional critical system, and it's scale invariant. Okay? So take that scale invariance and translate it into the entanglement entropy. And say that at each length scale, the entanglement entropy, so when I'm measuring the entanglement between two subregions of a one-dimensional system, imagine that at each length scale I get order one contribution. Very simply, okay? So at smallest length scale, before any renormalization group steps, I have one, order one times one. So I'm cutting like one, you know, singlet or something like that, whatever you want to call it, right? So let's perform an RG step. And I'm going to use a scale factor 2. So now I've coarse grained my lattice. So that instead of 8 sites, there's 4. And I get one more contribution, 1 plus 1 now, from that next length scale. Okay. Assuming that somehow I get a contribution from all the length scales, I go on, I do all these RG steps. What I have here is 1 plus 1 plus 1, which is 3. That's a limit to my analytical prowess. This is log base 2, because 2 is the scale dimension. Of 8 sites, so that's actually log L. And as everybody knows, or many people know, the log L scaling is the leading order scaling in one-dimensional critical systems, right? But as you also know, it's not the whole story. You don't just get a log L. You get a log L plus some shape-dependent term. And that shape-dependent term, I can imagine if I wrap this thing into a ring, I might have two boundaries. The shape dependence is sort of a probe of the gapless nature in the sense that it's a probe of how well these boundaries see each other. And so you can imagine some general function, again, I'm calling it gamma, that just takes this length scale into account, which is x over L. So very generally, in one dimension, using this argument, and then some much more hand-waving argument, I can imagine I have C log L plus some function x over L. And of course, all of these functions are well known from conformal field theory. So if you do this properly, then you actually get these two terms, a log of L, and a subleading quote-unquote term, which is log of some function. And that's sine, you know, pi x over L, which comes from that conformal mapping of a cylinder to a plane. And so what's remarkable in one dimension is that the coefficients of these two terms are the same. They depend on the central charge of the conformal field theory. They depend on the Reni index, which is at n. And that eta is just something which distinguishes between free or, you know, open and periodic boundary conditions. And it might seem like a detail, but it's also very important if we want to extract, for example, say, the central charge of the field theory from numerical methods. Okay, and in 1 plus 1, this is done quite often, or, you know, one spatial dimension, with things like density matrix and normalization group, where you have access to the reduced density matrix. Okay? So you have explicit access to that rho of A, which you need to calculate the entanglement entropies. And here's some sort of quick and dirty DMRG simulations or calculations on a 1D Heisenberg chain. And this sort of, I don't know, this rainbow shape is actually a sort of good indicator of gapless modes in the system, or of a gapless mode. Because I should have plotted it, but if you have a gapped system, then essentially, you know, this is a 128 finite size ring. You would get some sort of edge effect, and then this thing would flatten out in the center. So you can see very clearly that there's some sort of gapless shape dependence going on. And, you know, the second Reni entropy is this red thing here, this red data. And you can extract the central charge by just plotting this entropy instead of against the, you know, the real space chain length against this conformal distance, or this chord length, or whatever you call it. And then slope of these lines, the slope of the fit gives you the central charge, and you can C equals one up to some accuracy, which is determined by the finite size of the system. Incidentally, these are so well studied that even these subleading oscillations, you know, the source of those are known basically since 2010 in conformal field theory. So 1 plus 1 is quite well studied. So a note about quantum Monte Carlo is we don't actually have access to the reduced density matrix explicitly. So we can't calculate these things directly, these Rennie entropies, these von Neumann or Rennie entropies. But what we do have access to, and essentially the same way as field theory, is the integer n greater than or equal to 2 Rennie entropies. Okay, so there's some field theory, essentially papers up there. And the essential idea is that in the quantum Monte Carlo, which is really a D plus 1 classical Monte Carlo on a classical computer, right? This is why you have a sine problem in some cases. We just simulate directly this multi-sheeted Riemann surface. Okay, so this is supposed to represent a 1 plus 1 dimensional system. And this is actually this partition function ZA2T here, some funny partition function that's not physical. All these boundaries mean is that in my region A, so my one-dimensional region A, my world lines connect periodically with period 2 beta, whereas in region B, they connect periodically with beta. Okay, so in the same way that you might do this in a field theory. And what this gives access to, if I normalize it by the regular partition function, is the second Rennie entropy. So I don't have access to the first Rennie entropies, but I have access to S2, S3, S4, and so on. And I can do the same type of thing. I can imagine the same shape dependence by, you know, converging this thing to zero temperature, so extending my plus one dimension to some large amount, and then you know, varying my x length here, and I can get the same curve for S2. Okay, so we can examine the same shape dependence in 1 plus 1, but we can also examine other types of shape functions.
So I have a very basic question about these Rennie entropies. Sure. So as a function of n, what kind of information is there or lost?
So they're bounded. So the higher the Rennie entropy, the more you weight the largest eigenvalue of the reduced density matrix. So S infinity is like the single copy entanglement entropy or something they call it. S infinity only cares about the largest single value of the reduced density matrix. So you're losing information in some sense. Or you're parameterizing all these eigenvalue spectrum, if you will, of the reduced density matrix in some different way. So there's inequalities that are known. S1 is always greater than or equal to S2, always greater than S3, and so on. And in general, for things like the topological entanglement entropy, that index doesn't matter. Okay? But it does matter for some of these shape-dependent functions I'm going to talk about for the gapless systems. Okay? And you know, that's just a fact of life you got to deal with. So the only thing that makes me happy is essentially the field theories. Many of the field theories are also restricted to these n equals 2 and greater Rennie entropies. So I just want to make a note that you can connect, a d-dimensional quantum theory, a critical theory, to a d plus one-dimensional sort of classical stat-mech problem. And you can also study the entanglement scaling in classical systems, even though it's not entanglement in some sense. So for example, Monte Carlo can access finite temperature critical points. And at finite temperature, you might want to deal with this thing called a mutual information. This gets rid of a bulk contribution. You get volume law as you start to warm up the system. Here's a very simple simulation of a 2D Ising model, and I've in some way used the same replica trick here, but you can imagine my beta, you know, shrinks down, so I only have two slices. So I just have two replicas, a classical Monte Carlo system, and I can calculate the mutual information, which tells me something about the classical information bounds that are flowing between a subregion A and B. This mutual information, if I do finite size scaling, remarkably picks out the Ising critical point, 2.269 or whatever it is. And the shape dependence, so now I have a two-dimensional classical theory, which more complicated shape dependence. That shape dependence is universal in some sense. So if you know how, you can calculate the shape dependence from the lower dimensional conformal field theory. And you can also extract the central charge of the 1 plus 1 theory, which is something that we've only realized very recently, especially in collaboration with Paul and Jean-Marie Stéphane. So, you know, very simple classical models. If you have some classical, effective classical model of some interesting fixed point or something that you're calculating, and you can access a finite temperature critical point there, you can, in principle, say a lot about the lower dimensional quantum theory. But I want to get to 2D spatial entanglement. So I'm going to talk about two-dimensional systems now. And the first thing I'll do is talk about a specific geometry that's very simple to do in lattice simulations. And then I'll talk about something that's maybe a little more useful. So the first thing is two-cylinder entropies, I'm going to call it. And now I'm thinking of a 2 plus 1 critical theory. So the first thing you could ask me, is there still an area law? Bless you. So if you have a, if you have an area law for a gap system, it's not obvious that you have an area law maybe for a gapless system. So for a gap system, you have a length scale. And the simplest thing you can imagine is just having a single, here's my region A, here's my region B. I just have a single singlet going across each one of these bonds, something like that. And if each one gives me an order one contribution to the entanglement entropy, then I can imagine having L of these things, right? That's the boundary length L. And so there's my area law. But in a gapless system, you can ask whether that still applies. So let's do the same thing. Let's assume that we have one order one contribution from each length scale, and then I'll do an RG step. So here's my first RG step. And I've made my block spins, and I've given one order one unit of entanglement, or one bit or something. But there's only L by 2 of those length scales now. And here I have, again, L by 4. And so this all this subleading stuff here from the other length scales is this geometric series, which gives me another L. So here I only actually add up to 2L. So instead of log L, I get 2L. And so it's still an area law from this sort of heuristic or hand-wavy type argument. But really, this is what we find. We meaning people who study, I guess, interacting and non-interacting models. So although there are exceptions, of course, which I'll talk about, predominantly the rule of thumb, the boundary law or area law still applies to gapless systems. Okay? So the general expectation is that that subleading term is geometry dependent, like I mentioned. And there's been a lot of work on this geometry dependence. And I just wanted to mention one which will come back to haunt me later on in the talk, which is something that Eduardo and Joel did on these Z equals 2 quantum Lifshitz points, where they know quite well, or you know, exactly the subleading logarithmic contributions from a variety of boundaries on a disk. So here's a disk cut into A and B. Smooth surface gives you 0. This is the subleading log. Here, when the boundary intersects the disk into two pieces, you get some logarithmic dependence. And I'll talk about this and also these corners, these corner type geometries, and these corners give you a logarithmic contribution too. So this stuff's been studied in, you know, both non-interacting theories and these special sort of Z equals 2 Lifshitz points. And what I want to do is examine the simplest shape dependence that I can do on a finite size lattice. Okay, and a finite size lattice, typically you look at a toroidal system that minimizes boundary effects, and you can cut this in various ways that are commensurate with a lattice, if you will. And so the simplest thing to do is just cut a cylinder out of your torus. And I'm going to cut a cylinder out of the torus, and I'm going to, you know, there's only one parameter on a finite size system, which is the length of that cylinder, so that's x. And so I expect my area, my entanglement entropy to have an area law plus a subleading shape-dependent term that depends on x and depends on the aspect ratio of the system. That's the only lengths left in the lattice. Yeah.
So little L is now the circumference.
Little L is this right. Circumference plus this circumference, right? Yeah. So it's still the boundary length, yeah. So before I get to some fancy critical theory, what does this do in a, I don't know, pathological gapless state, like the Neel state? And this is the first thing we looked at, so now I'm giving my talk in historical perspective, which maybe isn't the most logical way to do it. But in a Heisenberg model in 2D, a two-dimensional Heisenberg model exhibits the same rainbow shape, which indicates you have a gapless system. Okay. But there's no shape-dependent function necessarily associated with that can be calculated exactly. So it's just sort of a probe, an indicator that there's something gapless. What there is, which is very important, is a subleading logarithmic term, which I won't talk about too much. And that subleading log, so it's log L, that subleading log, you know, comes from basically the Goldstone mode that's present when you're breaking your symmetry down, your continuous symmetry down. So there is a very strong subleading term that distinguishes between that type of continuous symmetry breaking and, for example, a gap phase or even a critical point. Sort of the second thing we looked at, again, in historical perspective, which became important, was an RVB wave function on a square lattice. So an RVB wave function is something that has singlets connecting nearest neighbor sites. And it's just an equal amplitude superposition of all those singlets. So you can imagine you can do this on triangular Kagame lattice and get something like a Z2 spin liquid. It's an SU2 invariant singlet. But of course, you might have a sign problem there. So this is something we can sample. And again, when we measure the second Rényi entropy as a function of, this is on a fixed size, L equals 24, as a function of x, so remember what x is? It's the length of the cylinder. We see, again, this smooth shape, which indicates that the system's gapless. There's actually two branches here, which is kind of interesting. And this two-branched behavior, which was kind of mysterious, was actually solved in an associated fixed point, which again is one of these z equals 2 quantum Lipschitz field theories, which can be solved exactly. And Jean-Marie basically derived a shape function. So this is the subleading universal shape function for that fixed point. And it fits that data for the RVB square lattice wave function very well. So actually, there's an even and an odd branch. I've just shown one of them. These are these Jacobi theta and Dedekind eta functions. So it's much more complicated than this log sign that you might expect from one plus 1d. But it actually fits the data. And in the limit, I guess the large n limit is the proper limit to take when you have hardcore dimers. It's exact. And you can study the finite size effects by doing these dimer calculations on lattices and comparing to the field theory and so on. And this is two aspect ratios. So again, there's x over l, and there's the aspect ratio of the lattice. So you can play all sorts of games. And say you had a bunch of trial functions or something like that. If you could get large enough system sizes in your lattice simulation, you can, in principle, figure out the critical theory from comparing to these types of scaling functions.
Is this a dimer model or a spin model?
So this is a SU2. So this is like a wave function, which is SU2 singlets. And this is for a dimer model, okay, so no spins. So the idea is that maybe it's like a large n limit, essentially, what this is solving for. So on the dimer, on the RVB, which is spin 1/2 or SU2, we don't have big enough system sizes to sort of numerically confirm that this shape-dependent function is an exact fit. Okay, there's some finite size scaling issue there. But in the case where you have hardcore dimers, it's exact. This is just like an RK wave function. It is an RK wave function. It's basically a two-dimensional system. That's what's special about these quantum Lipschitz points. That's why you can solve an RK point, right? It's because it's actually one lower dimension, and so it's still a two-dimensional shape function. But there's some trick to be able that you can't calculate these in 2+1. That's the point. But you can calculate them in some simplified cases like this RK point. But once somebody calculates it on the RK point, we can just try to jam that function into our data and see where it fits. And so that's what I'm going to do now. So we're going to look at something that's not exactly soluble. That's this 2+1, if you want, Ising fixed point. And we can simulate this with quantum Monte Carlo in the transverse field Ising model. So we know to high accuracy where the critical coupling is there. And of course, I don't know why I put this. It's because all the work for us goes into the algorithms and waste heat generated by the CPUs, but in the end, we can do this calculation with quantum Monte Carlo.
So, what algorithm do you use? Is just simply a three-dimensional Ising model?
Yeah, it's basically no. This is what I would call a quantum Monte Carlo, which isn't a 3D. It's not the exact mapping to a 3D Ising model.
It's like a worm.
Yeah, it's like a worm algorithm. Yeah, or any of that stuff like a path integral or whatever. So it's actually a zero temperature projector method, but it's just a path integral method. Yeah. So, so these are not like effective classical theories. These are directly done on the quantum system in D+1. But it maps to some sort of really non-trivial classical model you can imagine, or some StatMech problem. It's not even a model, right? Which is what quantum Monte Carlo is. So this is directly at the transverse field Ising model fixed point. So here's the shape. Yeah, I've only drawn half of it. So here's the shape-dependent function. And again, since you can't calculate the shape-dependent function exactly, you can just try fitting data to the only two candidates that we really have. So one is the one-dimensional theory. So what is y here? Y is x over l. Okay. So yeah, it's just this length x. So log sine, this is the one-dimensional shape function, and that's orange. And then this is the RVB shape function at that RK point, that z equals 2 Lipschitz theory. And so you could play all sorts of games with fitting these things on relatively large systems. And argue which one is a statistically better fit. By just eyeballing it, it looks like the RVB is a slightly better fit. But what we can do that's a little more sort of insightful is to look at the system size dependence of that leading or that coefficient of that subleading term. And so not to build a straw man argument, but it's been claimed in the past that this, you know, might be the right shape dependent function, and this will give you some access to the universality, if you will. But what we find is that's actually not true. The one-dimensional shape-dependent function leaves some size dependence left over in the coefficient, which is very clear. It even looks like a log somehow. Whereas if we use this shape-dependent function from the quantum Lifshitz point that Jean-Marie calculated, it's, you know, within statistical errors and finite size scaling, consistent with L independence. And there's some value that I can ascribe to it. So that function gives a good fit, actually gives a really good fit, and the coefficient of that thing is basically a constant at that fixed point. So it's fun to speculate regarding the universality of that function. And hopefully this is something that Eduardo and I will do during this trip, is speculate on the universality of this function. But we really need a little bit more systematic Monte Carlo, quantum Monte Carlo, and field theory calculations to really say if we're probing the exact universal theory there. So one thing that is important, which I really didn't emphasize too much, is that it's clear that there's no subleading log L term that would indicate symmetry breaking like a Goldstone mode. So that's absolutely clear. So I'm talking about some fairly sort of fine details of the finite size scaling, of the subleading scaling. It's absolutely clear that there's no such thing as like a subleading log. Well, I don't know. So I could just say I don't know, but you know, this central charge sneaks in there somewhere. In the 1+1 case, it sneaks in there. So in as much as the central charge relates or constrains some of these critical exponents.
For example, for the Goldstone,
do
you have
omega for the K? Oh yeah, so in the Goldstone mode case, so actually Ann Callan found this first in simulations of the Heisenberg model, this log dependence. But Max Malitsky and Taran Grover basically derive the coefficient, which is universal. So that's a number of Goldstone modes, the dimension -1/2. No, it just counts a number of gapless modes somehow, which each one contributes a log basically.
This is
consistent with our Heisenberg model, yeah. And actually, Bodan Kolchitsky right here, put your hand up, boy. He's going to be calculating this on the XY model. So we're going to actually confirm this to more accuracy. This has some finite size effect in lattice models that you have to be quite careful of. So. But we're completely consistent so far. Questions?
Can you relate those coefficients AL and C in terms of CFT correlation functions?
Can I personally? Yeah, maybe Rob. So A is non-universal. So it has a lattice length scale associated. So that's the area law piece. And what is J? It only depends on the aspect ratios and basically the functions that come in with the conformal mappings in two dimensions, as far as I know.
So the wave functions of the systems look like the conformal Gibbs waves of the 2D conformal field theory. And so in a sense, the norm of the wave function is the partition function. So that's the in that sense, it's a vague relationship in the stress tensor, but it's not entirely that. We try to make that case more on all paper, but I'm not really sure if I can use my own.
Okay, I only have 5 minutes left, so let's talk about universal contributions due to vertices. So again, this is something that occurs in the shape. What's a vertex? A vertex is a fancy word for a corner. So if I have a corner, and I'm in a scale invariant system, and I imagine that corner gives me order one entanglement, whatever that means. Okay, so I get order one times one, whatever. That's what my entanglement looks like for a corner. I'm going to do the same this RG argument, okay? And when I do my first RG step, you know, I still have only one corner, right? I get one. And I do a second RG step, I still only get one corner. So as I add these all up, just like in one dimension, when I added up all the modes, if you will, crossing that boundary, I just get a log L in this case. So it's log base 2/8, but it's so you can imagine that a subleading corner might give you a corner might give you a subleading log. And I imagine this all the time. But people have done way more sophisticated calculations than that. And Cassini and Huerta have a nice paper from 2007 where they show that not only does the corner give you some sort of log contribution, the coefficient of that log is universal. Okay, and it depends on the angle of that corner. Okay, so now what we're looking at, okay, and you can read this if you want to know why, is an area law plus a subleading log due to that corner, okay, plus, and so I'm imagining that shape is fixed, or those aspect ratios in that shape-dependent function are fixed, so like they're gone away. And I have some angle dependence, and what I'll do on a lattice is just set my angle to be 90 degrees. In principle, we could probe that. And also the coefficient, this A, there's one contribution for every corner. Okay. So if you have four corners and a square, you get four times that. So Cassini and Huerta calculated this for non-interacting theory. And they actually have the coefficient, and they have the theta dependence, and they have some numerical calculations, and they also have some analytical calculations of functions of theta. And something I can immediately address is the n equals 2, so the second Reni entropy, 90 degree corner calculation. That's something that you can just put on a lattice right away. And their value, after several phone calls, is minus 0.0064. Okay, so they can calculate this to basically fourth decimal place. Here's my interacting theory. This is my Wilson-Fisher fixed point, 2 plus 1. Okay, they're at a Gaussian fixed point. Again, I have to do a finite size scaling of a lattice. I've got finite size tori. And I scale these things such that the aspect ratio of my region A is fixed. So I'm getting rid of that shape-dependent term. But I should be getting four contributions from corners. Okay, and each one of them gives me a log. This is what the log looks like. Okay, there's a negative sign. Up to some boundary length, getting close to something like 80. And what I get at the Wilson-Fisher fixed point, after a whole bunch of fitting and error propagation and so on, is 0.006 and with the error bar of 2 on there. So again, here it's minus 0.0064. What I get is 0.006 with some error bar. And so it's actually really close to the free theory. And actually, I can plot all sorts of estimates from the literature. Here's that 90 degree corner contribution as a function of Reni index. Okay, so Ann Callan's calculated in some link cluster expansion. There's tensor networks. There's all sorts of series from Rajiv Singh's group. And that value I showed you is this. I'm ashamed of it, so that's why it's so light. It's in yellow. And the error bar is this big thing here. And the green is the Gaussian calculation, the free field theory by Cassini and Huerta. And so you see I'm well within that free fixed point value within error bars. Although both the series and the link cluster expansions, some of these other methods, especially the purple has access to the reduced density matrix directly, and so that's why I have all the Reni entropies here. These, we believe, are different than the Gaussian theory within error bars. So the quantum Monte Carlo still has something to do to catch up. Although we're starting to get a handle on these numbers, especially for the Ising fixed point, it's still sort of a question in my mind whether I can use that number, which is known to be universal, to distinguish between those fixed points. That's still something we have to work on. And what I should have thought of like a year and 200 to 400 CPU years ago was actually doing what Eduardo did, was where I cut the system into two disconnected regions. And if I take my cylinder and I cut it into two rectangles, each one of those rectangles has a 90 degree corner associated with a boundary, which I believe will eliminate all sorts of sort of finite size shape dependence that's inherent in the square. So again, this is evolving as we go on, our knowledge of how to do these, but hopefully we'll be able to sort of converge something to more accuracy using this method here. So that's where we are now. In the future, we're going to look at other fixed points. So Anne's working on code for the O3 universality class in 2 plus 1 as we speak. So we do this on a Heisenberg bilayer, where we vary the coupling between the bilayers to access a fixed point there. And so it'll be interesting to compare that to the Gaussian theory and also the Ising fixed point. There's an interesting open problem that I still haven't figured out what's going on, because in principle, especially to access these quantities that Senthil are talking about and Tarun in this sort of this C-theorem type subleading terms, it'd be nice to be able to do lattice calculations where we take a curved boundary and regularize this thing, or so study a curved boundary on a lattice. But what people have claimed is that you run into problems with pixelization effects. So, you know, how do I pixelize this boundary such that I'm capturing a curve that has a certain radius or whatever. And actually, Cassini and Huerta have a free theory calculation where they look at the subleading term as a function of radius on a square lattice, or the theory is regularized on a square lattice, and this subleading thing just jumps all over the place and doesn't converge. So remarkably, several people are apparently trying to reproduce this calculation now, including me. I failed because I don't know what I'm doing, but Tarun Grover and Brian Swingle are actually looking at this right now as we speak. So there's still some sort of unresolved issue about, even in the free theory, whether or not we can converge that subleading term due to a curved boundary.
So this means you want to take a lot of little corners all over the place.
Well, that's the thing, is you imagine getting a little log from every corner somehow, and then they have to cancel in just the right way, right? Like it's actually not obvious that that thing converges. So if you know, and this one purpose of this talk, this is some, you know, very routinely calculated quantity in field theory, but it's still not clear if we can access this in lattice simulations. So I can't do anything in the free theory for some reason, so I skip right by to the, in principle, more difficult interacting theory. And Steve Ingalls, who will be around this afternoon, is basically doing this pixelization in a very systematic way at the transistorizing model fixed point. And he's actually getting a subleading term that looks like it might converge. So within the next, say, 100 years, 100 CPU years, we should basically have a better handle about whether we can converge a subleading quantity, at least in the interacting case. So hopefully these calculations will converge at the same time. So just as a plug, we have the simulation technology. We have all these Rennie entropies in quantum Monte Carlo, all variants. I mean, we have like finite temperature SSE, world line, zero temperature projector. We have path integral methods now that are in the continuum. Since 2010, essentially when we figured out how to do this, we've sort of propagated this multi-sheeted Riemann surface idea through all flavors of quantum Monte Carlo now. So all these things are accessible. It's just we have to know what to look at, essentially. It'd also be nice to look at exceptions to the area law. And so there's a nice recent paper by Nick Bonesteel's group where he essentially shows that, if you have a boson system, in principle, it doesn't have a sign problem. You have this Bose surface, like these exciton Bose liquid models that Matthew Fisher and other people work on. I mean, it's been sort of speculated in the past that these things have multiplicative log violations of the area law. And I think this is on much firmer footing now. And, this multiplicative log violation has nothing to do with emergent fermions or any sort of fermionic spin-on statistics that are in the problem. Non-interacting boson models, when they have a Bose surface in these Bose metals or whatever, can actually have this violation. So this might be something that quantum Monte Carlo could look at in the future. And again, just as a feel-good ending, Rennie entropies, I think precisely because they're this replicated system, will be the things that I think that can be experimentally measured or experimentally accessed in the far future. So that's another good reason to keep looking at these quantities. Okay, thank you very much. So you would hope not, right? But of course, we haven't tested it yet on. Yeah. So I think pixelization problems will be different, specifically on different lattices. Yeah. But in principle, these corner contributions and stuff should only depend on the angle. That So it'd be nice to look at a system that you can coarse grain in such a way that maybe you can look at the angle dependence. Yeah. Exactly. Like something like that. So. All in the future.
There are a couple of comments on that. These sort of logarithmic terms also appear in people that do engage theory calculations of Wilson loops. If the Wilson loops are not smooth, but they have cusps,
Right.
You also get these sort of logarithms coming from that. So they have a common origin. The other is it's possible that there is something taking to the roughening transition. Here that in a sense, if you imagine that, you need to discretize your counter.
Right.
At least in the dimer type law, you can imagine this in terms of heights. So essentially, you will be trying to stabilize different types of crystal surfaces in the language.
And like around, possible that you mean around this boundary here?
Yeah, and those things, like when you look at crystal shapes, they have constantly established type transitions. You see the between interface between a flat and a smooth boundary. So it's possible that to actually get something smooth, you may have to go to very long landscapes.
So it's a good, it's interesting because really what we're probing somehow is the geometry of the D plus one dimensional, you know, region A and B, the surface of that region, and how it intersects with that multi-sheeted Riemann surface. So it's like, you know, it's like the boundary theory of that thing. So you can do, in D plus one, you can play other games like kink that boundary or make it of different topological, like non-trivial topological structures. And so, you know, my kind of dream is that in the far future, we could probe exactly what contributions give rise to what sort of universal subleading terms.
But it's possible to get something which is smooth, like what you would have expected in continuum. You may cut to
right.
The little red bits.
Yeah.
So, you can sort of rough it up.
It's good for me, bad for the environment.
So for the Bose method, is that, do you have a variation wave function or is it?
This is done on Hamiltonian with DMRG.
Most.
Well, so Donna Shang and Lessing Motrinich have this like they have one spin model, okay, that has like a foresight term, but it also exists on like a fermionic Hubbard model that has either longer range interactions or like range change terms. So that's some work in progress out of Santa Barbara, but I can show you the Hamiltonians, yeah. So there's Hamiltonian work on that.
With some spin with wing exchange.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
People are hungry? Okay, so let's thank Roger again.
Thank you.